My name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording record by record. Welcome back to this brand new season, season 8 of this podcast, Ridiculous. I don't know if I've mentioned this before. I can't remember if I've mentioned this on the show before. I don't think I have. I would go back and listen, but it's absolute torture to hear my own voice. But I think in the break between the last two seasons, it was, we hit 1 million downloads, 1 million downloads on this podcast. So I just wanted to say thank you. What an insane mark to cross, 1 million downloads. That's absolutely blown my mind. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading every single time the podcast has returned. And thank you if you have bought a coffee. This is a kind of a little like tipping system, if you like. Helps keep the podcast running, helps keep the podcast uploaded to the server, costs and all that. So thank you to Marcus, who has done that. Hello to Dino. Hi to Sarah. Jay, thank you for supporting. Hi to Walt too, who has supported recently. And hi to JF, who has also supported via Buy Me a Coffee. There's a link in this episode's description. Let's get to today's episode, shall we? And I'm afraid to say we're following a kind of good album, or a middling Bob Dylan album in the last episode, with a disappointing Bob Dylan album. In fact, an album that some have called his worst. I think it probably is his worst, because it's not even really an album. You can't even really call it a bad album, because it's just a sort of collection of songs that have been lumped together in a slightly horrible commercial way. So we're going to take a look at it and try and work out if it's really quite bad or if there's some redeeming qualities. This is the 1973 album, Dylan.
Take a trip on the Big Black Moon. Sarah Jane.
Sarah Jane.
Sarah Jane.
Sarah Jane.
Ain't nothing to do but to sit down and sing and rock about my Sarah Jane.
The Marriage Foundation declared in 2017 that the average marriage is 38 years long. And while Bob Dylan has had two marriages, that we know of course, there's another union in his life that has stood the test of time. It's seen him through difficult moments of despair and moments where he's altered the collective brain chemistry of generations. Dylan and his label Columbia have been together much longer than the average marriage. In fact, it's closer to double in length. And while it pretty much has been a match made in heaven, unusual for the music industry, as with any long-term relationship, it hasn't been completely perfect. With a career as long as Bob's, eventually there's going to be some messy admin. But actually, in the world of Beach Boys lost albums, differing Beatles releases either side of the Atlantic, and rearranged track lists on classic albums, Bob's career, despite being lengthy, has remained pretty clean-cut in terms of releases. Well, more clean-cut than you'd expect, at least. This is mainly because he's released nearly every single album he's made on Columbia Records. Despite the label changing almost unrecognisably since Dylan signed to it at 20 years old, their relationship has been solid. Columbia, it has to be said, has done a great job, along with Bob's management, of overseeing his recording career. Their work on the bootleg series has been an industry-leading light in how to work a re-release schedule. I say nearly every album because after an exhilarating 12-album run with Columbia Records, in which he'd gone electric and gone country and gone off his motorbike, he then went to Asylum Records, a brand new home. Here he'd get back together with the band and cut the Planet Waves album. And while that would be a good, if not great, album, in my opinion, and while it would work to a certain degree commercially, it wouldn't quite be the home run I think it was conceived as being at the very beginning. Check the Planet Waves episode to work out why that might be the case. But why did Bob move labels after such a lot of success with Columbia? Well, there was a slight souring of the relationship. His contract expired, and Bob felt like he wasn't really being treated as well as he could. While Columbia have gone to great lengths in recent decades to preserve Bob as a Hall of Famer, there is an argument to say at this point in his career, he was a slightly reduced force. He apparently felt like they'd lost interest, which makes his Columbia comeback with the legendary album Blood on the Tracks even more majestic in hindsight. Back in 73, though, and he's off to David Geffen's Asylum label. Geffen, a baffling celebrity in his own right, seems pretty good at PR and selling all types of media. And Dylan clearly thought this was a positive, something that might get him back to the sort of sales he had been capable of at the start of his career. At this point, his last three albums had failed to go platinum, while his previous five had. Geffen was good at shifting units, and the label was home to some big bankers. And the whole thing works to a degree. I mean, the sales for the album were good and it went to number one. Geffen is at pains to point out that this was a success. He's quoted as saying, "We shipped 771,000 Planet Waves album. We've taken back less than 15%, which is standard for the industry. So around about 110,000. Basically, the album will end up doing around 600,000. But Dylan and Geffen's personalities apparently clashed. According to Fred Goodman's book, Mansions on the Hill, Dylan thought that Geffen was more interested in being a celebrity than anything else. After a successful 1974 tour, Dylan couldn't work out why millions of people wanted to see him live, but not as many had bought the records. He thought Geffen had failed him in that respect. This is sort of up for debate. I mean, this is a commercial record for Dylan. It's one of his most commercial records, I think. But even at his height, Bob has never been a top-level seller. He was back with Columbia after just a year on David Geffen's label. He signed a deal that reportedly paid him 60 cents a record more than the Asylum deal, and it gave him new improved royalties on his back catalogue, a key part of the deal which Dylan is still benefiting from today. He would channel this momentum into the classic LP Blood on the Tracks, which was his first release on that new deal, like I mentioned earlier, going double platinum in the process and finally breaking that platinum-less run. But that was all in the future. When Dylan actually decided to defect to Geffen's label, Columbia didn't just rest on their laurels and think about what they had. Like most record companies, they decided to cash in on their IP for a quick-fire sale. And like most occasions when companies decide to do this, it didn't work. Columbia released a very strange album, a compilation of covers, outtakes and offcuts. A bitter little move that in the end no one really benefited from, least of all us listeners. On this album, we start as we mean to go on, with a traditional song called Lily of the West. It features a bass line that is less than convincing in its early moments. It feels a little ramshackle as Charlie E. Daniels gets his notes a bit mixed up. But it's not just that. The whole song feels like the moment sort of right before you lose your balance. You know you're about to fall over and you can't do anything to stop it.
First I came to Louisville, some pleasure there to find. A damsel there from Lexington was pleasing to my mind. Her rosy cheeks, her ruby lips, like arrows pierce my brain.
This song, like a lot of others here, comes from the New Morning sessions. It's the second take of the song that we hear on the LP, coming from the second New Morning session, which happens on the 3rd of June 1970. And actually, despite the disjointed opening, it builds into a, well, pretty nice arrangement. Al Cooper is on the organ, which sounds like a harpsichord, which reminds me of George Martin's take on the Beatles classic In My Life. The backing vocals are pretty good too, and this combined with the Wild West tone reminds me of All the Tired Horses, Self-Portrait genre mixer from Bob's 1970 album. And actually, it's interesting to note that both that LP and this one share a lot of similarities. But that LP felt like Dylan constructing his own bootleg album, a self-portrait of his work, of the work that made him, while this feels like an unauthorized biography. Next up, we have a cover of Can't Help Falling in Love, which sounds like it comes from the New Morning universe, and that's because it's from those sessions too. In fact, it's from the very same session as Lily of the West. There's three takes of this song, and in true Bob style, they get a decent or even half-decent cut and move on. That comes on the third go. And it's fine. It's a nice little breeze around the Elvis classic that appeared at the start of the previous decade. Dylan brings his spirit to it. It's kind of interesting to hear a song interpreted by so many different artists. I mean, so many people have actually covered this song. Can't Help Falling in Love is a song that people do in their own style, whether they like it or not. And this sounds very mid-career Dylan, complete with a delicate harmonica solo.
Thank you.
2 days before recording this, Dylan was in the studio once again with Bob Johnston and the New Morning team. But this next song doesn't sound like the other two here. It's a cover of the traditional song Sarah Jane, and for my money, it's actually a little more street legal than New Morning. Dylan's voice is markedly different here. We've gone from the croon of New Morning, which is like a diluted performance of Nashville Skyline in my mind, but here that southern tinge has been completely shaken off. Dylan's delivery is more up and at 'em. His rat-a-tat flow on the verses takes us back to 65, even behind the Savoy Hotel. But it's the chorus of Lars, complete with backing vocals, that feel like a prelude to the aforementioned Street Legal. The direction of Russ Kunkel on drums seems to be just make some noise and we'll record that, which he pretty much does. Yes, the bar has been set low for this album already. The song here is, in essence, Dylan's version of a Steamboat song called Rock Around My Sarah Jane. This has been called one of Dylan's worst songs, but wait for the hot take. I kind of like it. I don't care. It's fun. And my God, this album does need a little bit of fun. It also does something we've seen time and time again from Bob, and something we usually see in hindsight. It's difficult to spot as it's happening. But this acts as an indicator of where he would go next. We see this often with Bob, whether it's the tones and themes of Oh Mercy launching a brand new era of his career that arguably we're still seeing right up to Rough and Rowdy Ways, or the diligent reporting of the Bible, say, in John Wesley Harding, that would resurface a decade later on a trio of, quote, religious albums. It's kind of fun to spot them as we go through his career, and it shows that Dylan's often regular changes in style are organic and not forced or decided on for commercial gain, unlike some stars. This track also cuts loose and, like I say, has a little bit of fun. This is where the album falters for me. Sometimes it's just a bit, I don't know, unexciting. I don't mean it's boring. I mean it's like going to a magic show once you've seen how the tricks are conceived. It's still enjoyable to a degree, but there's a real lack of magic that we see even on some mid-range Bob albums. This song is a nice little distraction from all that, but by the time we hit track 4, we are back to where we were. In the same session as Sarah Jane is the Ballad of Ira Hayes, and it returns us to New Morning style with a If Dogs Run Free half-spoken delivery from Bob.
About a brave young Indian, you should remember well. From the tribe of Pima Indians, a proud and a peaceful band, who farm the Phoenix Valley and Arizona land.
The song was written by Peter Lafarge, the legendary Greenwich folk singer, and Don of the scene when Bob starts out. The song's words tell the story of Ira Hayes, who was one of six Marines who became famous for raising the US flag during the Battle of Iwo Jima in World War II, an act captured in the iconic photo by Joe Rosenthal. After the war, Hayes suffered from post-traumatic stress and turned to alcohol, and after a night of heavy drinking on January the 23rd into the 24th, 1955, he died of exposure to the cold and alcohol poisoning. It is the reason why in the song's chorus, the lyrics read, "Call him drunken Ira Hayes. He won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey-drinking Indian or the Marine that went to war." The final reframe of this is particularly heartbreaking, as Dylan sings, "Yeah, call him drunken Ira Hayes, but his land is just as dry, and the ghost is lying thirsty in the ditch where Ira lies." He was buried with full military honours on February the 2nd, 1955.
And when the fight was over, and Old Glory raised, one of the men who held it high was the Indian Ira Hayes. Call him drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey drinking Indian or the Marine who went to war. Call him drunken Ira Hayes.
Next on the album is quite a shift, as Dylan, or rather Columbia, decides to hit us with a cover of the Jerry Jeff Walker song Mr. Bojangles. While it's been covered a whole heap of times, it is a song that can shift and reform with ease. Dylan's version here is actually pretty good for my money. It's quite complex musically, especially as we enter the chorus. Dylan's voice is a world away compared to the previous track. In fact, if nothing else, this record is a good example of how Dylan too can change and reform with ease. He belts out the chorus, giving it a poppy melody. This is not Bob's deepest emotive cut, but then again, on an album of offshoots, we can't really expect that. So we should probably enjoy this for what it is. The actual story of the song is pretty interesting. It takes us to New Orleans and to jail. Walker was apparently inspired to write it after an encounter with a street performer while incarcerated for public intoxication in 1965. There he met a homeless man who called himself Mr. Bojangles, to conceal his true identity from the police, of course. He had been arrested as part of a police sweep of indigent people that had been carried out following a high-profile murder. Apparently, Mr. Bojangles talked to people in the jail about all manner of things. But when he told a story about his dog, the mood in the room turned heavy. When it was suggested that he lighten the mood, he obliged with a tap dance. Bob sings here, "I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you in worn-out shoes with silver hair, a ragged shirt and baggy pants. He would do the old soft shoe.
I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you in worn-out shoes, silver hair, ragged shirt, and baggy pants. That old soft shoe. It jumped so..."
The recording for this song comes in the third New Morning session on the 2nd of June 1970. It's the session that is sandwiched between the second session on the 1st, which brought us the previous two songs, Sarah Jane and the Ballad of Ira Hayes, and obviously the fourth session on the 3rd of June, which is slightly complicated, I know, but go with it. These are not fertile sessions for the New Morning album. In fact, from these, only One More Weekend makes it out alive and onto the parent album. And that comes right at the end of the third day in the very final recording moments. So what we have here in these sessions is very much Dylan finding a sound. We know he likes each record to have an identified sound where possible, so this feels like he is very much working at that, pinning it down using songs he likes to try and find that sound or that feel, which makes this compilation even less compelling. These really don't feel like hidden gems at all. They're more like sketches. And that is even more true for Dylan's cover of Joni Mitchell's Big Yellow Taxi. Joan and Bobby have a long and slightly complicated relationship. Clearly, they respect each other's work. Mitchell is on record as saying, "There came a point when I heard a Dylan song called Positively 4th Street. And I thought, oh my God, you can write about anything in songs. This was a revelation to me." Bob liked her enough to invite her on the Rolling Thunder Review Tour, which would be eventful for her, to say the least. Although it's not always been completely rosy between them. Mitchell played Dylan a preview of her 1974 album Court and Spark at a David Geffen party. And apparently mid-listening session, Dylan simply dozed off. Joni was not impressed. For the record, that's a great album. Famously, in later years, she said of Bob, "Musically, Dylan's not very gifted. He's borrowed his voice from the old hillbillies. He's got a lot of borrowed things. He's not even a great guitar player. He's invented a character to deliver his songs. It's a mask of sorts." Now, Bob loves a mask-wearing analogy, so I'm sure he took actual positivity out of that quote. And to be fair, Dylan has borrowed a hell of a lot over the years. She's not wrong. And for my money, Joni is probably the only other artist in this universe of songwriters that can match Dylan. I don't think she quite has the volume of Bob, but pound for pound, song for song, she is the only one who can take him to the finish line, in my mind. So these two powerhouses putting their creative juices into the same song must be a good thing, right? Well, no. Although I will say many a Dylan fan grimaces with a horrified look at the mere mention of this cover. To be honest, it's not that bad. Sure, I rarely find myself punching in Bob Dylan Big Yellow Taxi on my Apple Music, and my copy of Dylan rarely makes it onto my record player, but its reputation is worse than it actually is. Not that it means that this album is any good, or this song is any good. Just to be clear, it's not. Dylan gives us some Desire-era vocals as they loosely guide us through this classic, sucking out its previous bizarre energy, and I mean that in a good way, that Mitchell placed in it in 1970. Here it's just a little bit... ugh. To be fair, though, the song had only been released 2 months before Dylan covered it, so he might not have had a full handle on it. But it's just uninspiring.
Late last night, I heard my screen door slam. A big yellow bulldozer took away the house and land. Don't it always go to show? You never know what you got till it's gone.
Incredibly, despite its blandness, this is not the worst cover of this brilliant song. I'm very much a Counting Crows apologist, but when the band covered it in 2002, they literally paved paradise and put up a terrible mess of a parking lot in this song. Google the Village Voice review for more comedy metaphors in this vein. Back to the bob cut, and like I say, it's just north of terrible. Not completely terrible, but certainly getting there. For the next track on the LP and the record's penultimate cut, we go upbeat. But unfortunately, we're still in Blandstown. Bob reverts back to the Nashville Skyline croon over a snappy cover of A Fool Such As I. The song is by American songwriter Bill Trader, and it was first published in 1952. Trader sold a few songs, including this, and it would become a hit for Hank Snow, Joe Stafford, and, of course, Elvis Presley. I kind of feel with Bob, if Sinatra or Woody or Elvis did it, then he wants in. Bob loves a bit of enigmatic songwriter cosplay, and why not? It's enjoyable for him and for us. Here, though, I'm disappointed to say that once again, it's just a bit dull. It's hard listening to a song like this in this style in 2023 because it's always going to be difficult to get excited about it with our current ears on. But compare this to the stuff he was producing in and around this period, and this song is streets behind. Again, it's easy to see why it didn't make it onto any other album apart from this. Unlike the rest of the album, this song doesn't actually come from those 1970s sessions. This is actually from a year earlier, being cut on the 26th of April, 1969. This is the second session for Self Portrait. Bob Johnston is, of course, the producer, whilst Dylan's band is Bob Wilson on piano, Norman Blake on guitar, Charlie Daniels also on guitar, Fred Carter on guitar too, Charlie McCoy on bass, Peter Drake on steel guitar, and Kenny Butcher on drums. This session takes place with a couple of runs. They record from 6 till 9 and then again from 10 till 1. They rattle through his songs Let It Be Me, I Forgot More Than You'll Ever Know, and Take Me As I Am, while the second song was A Fool Such As I. Every song is a one-take wonder, apparently, which sort of shows you the process not only for this album, but also, slightly more worryingly, for the more high-profile Self-Portrait. It was very much a cut-and-go sort of record. The session before this one, and Self-Portrait first, was a little less breakneck. Only two songs made up that session. The first one was Living the Blues, which after six takes makes the Self-Portrait album, while the other one was Spanish is the Loving Tongue.
Spanish is the loving tongue, soft as music, late as spring.
They give it seven goes in the session, and this is cut number seven. Once they got it, the session was over. It's a song that dispels that annoying myopic myth that Dylan can't sing. His vocal opener, again in that drawl, is beautiful. He merges well with the backing vocals and clearly enjoys the undercurrent of melodrama to it all. The music for Loving Tongue was written in 1925, and among those who recorded it would be Tom Paxton and Judy Collins and Marianne Faithfull. The song was originally a poem called A Border Affair and was written by Charles Badger Clark in 1907. It deals with love in a time of racial and class divisions. What's interesting about this, though, is that Dylan becomes slightly obsessed with this song. There's multiple versions of him covering it. Nearly all have been released in some form or other. I have particular love for his solo piano version. From 1968 to 1976, though, he records it regularly. He records a version during the basement tapes. Then, in the second Blood on the Track session on the 17th of September 1974, he's once again with the song Between Cutting Tangled Up in Blue and Cool Letter Blues. In New York on October the 19th, 1975, he's once again recording the song. But then it sort of fizzles out. He doesn't really record it too many times after that. How come Dylan seems so hot on this song and then it dies? Perhaps he'd been wrestling with the themes and the tone of this particular cut for a while and finally found around the time of Blood on the Tracks that he'd managed to create something that isn't a million miles away from it in his own voice. Perhaps he exercised some sort of demon that he wanted with this song in his own words on Blood on the Tracks. Or perhaps he just got bored of playing it so regularly. Either way, on the version that appears on Dylan, it's a pretty good way to finish. There's some nice, if pretty obvious, instrumentation, and it leaves you with a pleasing feeling. And whilst it's not Dylan at his best, it's a, well, pretty good listen. As the final bars of this song ring out, you realise this is a strange album to contend with. It should have never really existed at all. It seems bizarre and bitter that Columbia would jump to release this in the way they did. Even more bizarre is that it didn't damage their relationship with Dylan ahead of his return. And as I always seem to do with the worst albums, you go in feeling like this is going to be terrible, only to be reminded it's actually not that bad, even if it is bad. Would we have different feelings on this if expectations weren't as high as every other Dylan album? Of course, and even more so when we know what would happen after this record, what sort of form he would discover later on. In the context of this being the latest Dylan record, though, it's no wonder it was met with such a reaction. While this has softened to a degree today, it's not like there is a lot here to actually redeem it in terms of songs. So more a case of not as bad as you might think, but still pretty bad. And while we shouldn't spend too much time poring over this record, even though we do, in a career like Dylan's, it's important to have downs as well as ups. That is it for this episode of the popular Bob Dylan podcast, Bob Dylan album by album. Thank you for listening. Do you know what? That just reminded me, actually, listening to the final bits of this episode. I had two messages on Twitter from two separate people, right, who last week obviously found out that at the end of last week's podcast, I said we're going to cover this album this week. They both said that they really like it and hope that I don't do it dirty, to quote one of them. It's not that good, is it? I mean, come on. I think the majority of people will think this is not his best. But according to Twitter, at least a couple in the world do like it. Share your thoughts on this album, please. You can find us on Twitter and on Instagram at Bob Dylan Podcast. Next time, we're having a look at a significantly better album. Tempest is where we go next time. An album that some people think is Dylan's best record. It certainly comes in a real purple patch for him, or at least comes at the end of a real purple patch for him. We'll get to that next week. In the meantime, as always, thanks for listening, and I'll see you down the road.